The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I don't even have my glasses out yet. That's how fast I had to come out here. But I think that this audience will probably forgive me if I say that the reason that I'm a little late is because I just did Marty Mascoigne's show. Right? I mean, we all agree that she does one of the great public radio shows in this country. I was thinking about the fact when I was thinking about being here today, being back here today, which is such a pleasure, that in my line of work, you never forget your first book. Not the first one you owned, the first one you wrote. I can vividly remember the morning when my father came home after Mass carrying a stack of Sunday papers that almost blocked a view of his face because my byline was on page one for the first time. And I can vividly remember the evening that I persuaded a security guard at the New York Times to hand over an early edition that was still warm from the presses that contained my first column. But there's no question that the biggest day of all was when the FedEx man drove up and handed me a copy of Living Out Loud, and I saw my name on the cover. Just stood there hefting it. Which gives me a particular point of view on what is now clearly conventional wisdom, and that is that the book is dead. I keep hearing that the book is dead as I'm sitting writing yet another one in a room lined with them. Technology is going to kill it. The libraries of the world are going to become museums. And you know what? I don't believe it. It's part of something that I think is peculiarly American, and that's bringing an either-or mentality to everything. I mean, in case you haven't noticed, at this moment in time, the President of the United States is either baby Jesus or the Antichrist, depending on where you're coming from. So when we're looking at all these issues, I went back and looked at the clips and books and magazines. Endless pieces about how the invention of television was going to mean the end of radio. Endless pieces about how movies were going to be the end of live theater. Pieces about how recorded music was going to mean the end of live music and concerts. And yet we all know sitting here today that all of those forms still exist, sometimes overshadowed by their newer siblings, but not extinct. And despite all of these predictions, I think reading in all forms is going to be part of the life of the mind, even as we all feel like computers are as essential as a pen, and books, instead of flying off of store shelves, are now flying into the Kindle or the iPad. I have to believe that. I mean, as you heard, I grew up in Drexel Hill, in a lovely center hall colonial with a club chair in the living room right near the fireplace. And when I think of my childhood, I am in that club chair. I'm sort of draped over it with my scabby knees over one arm. And in my mind, I am always there reading. And in my mind, my mother is always standing in the doorway of the living room, and she's always saying the same thing. She's always saying, it's a beautiful day outside. No matter if it could be raining, it's a beautiful day outside. All your friends are outside, and you know what? All my friends were outside. I mean, I went out with them sometimes down to the creek, down to Naylor's Run. You know there's parts of the world where people don't say creek? That astonishes me. And it never was exactly right for me. I always felt like the best part of me was back in that room, in that book, laid flat on the table like a game of statues. All those people frozen until I was going to pick up the book again and bring them all back to life. But the truth is that after I became an English major in college and then went into the business of words, I realized that the world in some ways is as hostile to the act of reading as my girlfriends had been when they were telling me to put down that stupid book and come outside. Because, again, I think it's peculiarly American that while we keep paying lip service to the virtues of reading, there's something in this culture that's so activist that suspects people who read as dreamers, as people who need to grow up and come outside where real life is. I mean, I can't tell you how many captains of industry have leaned into me at dinner parties and confided in this kind of self-congratulatory way that they don't have time to read. They're just too busy. They're too important. Every once in a while, one of them confides in me that his wife belongs to a book club. I mean, it's all I can do not to stab them with the salad fork. And by the way, maybe that helps explain why so many of them have wound up in such a jam. A little War and Peace can teach you how to run a big business. And they make reading sound like a luxury when I think that it's an absolute necessity in a democracy. Because words are what break down the barriers among us. Words are what won't allow the big lies to stand. To my mind, in a democracy, it is more of a threat to cut library budgets than to cut defense budgets. And that's why I think reading will maintain in all kinds of different forms, whether it's a digital book or an actual one, because it is that protection against the big lies. It is the thing that allows the bright lines that divide us not to stand. Information, stories, words, they tell us over and over again that we're more alike than different. They help us to understand the world, and they help us to understand themselves. That's what reading is for me. It's to help me understand myself. And it's what writing does for me, too. Long before I went to work at the New York Times, there was a very famous editor and columnist there named James Reston, known to most people as Scotty. And he once said something that always rang so true to me. How can I know what I think until I read what I write? Well, at some level, I don't. I mean, despite the fact that I'm not writing a regular column now and instead yelling at the television set, or my poor husband who says, I agree with you about the Arizona immigration law. But, I mean, the truth is I don't fully know what my best thoughts are about gun control or affirmative action or my kids or loss or most other subjects until I've wrestled with the words on the page. Because the concrete version of the sentiment makes me reevaluate them, think more carefully, understand more completely, and therefore understand myself more thoroughly. When I say that at colleges or universities, I can tell the students are thinking, yeah, that's because you're a writer. I think we have to get past this notion that writing is for writers. Writing is for everybody because I've learned, and we all should learn, to use the written word in the way it was meant to be used as a legacy of your life. I mean, I think about this all the time. If I were hit by a bus on the corner of 72nd and Broadway in Manhattan, what would there be left of me for my children? And in my case, at this moment, the answer is really satisfying because they would have my words. They could pick up a book or an old magazine, and there I would be talking to them alive again, my words in their heads. That is who I am at some level. My voice is who I am, and I need that. But I think all of us do in ways that we don't sufficiently appreciate. I mean, if you're a lawyer and you can produce a really great brief, you may really be able to get somebody out of a jam. If you're a research scientist and you write a terrific grant proposal, you might get the money to do real good for generations of human beings. If you're an executive and you can mesmerize the people who work with you with your words, you're almost guaranteed success as a leader. Writing is probably the only thing that we learn in school, with the possible exception of music and art, that can totally belong to us. I mean, history has its facts, and math has its formulas, but writing is putting one word after another however you choose. And sometimes I think, why do we so avoid this connection with other human beings, this opportunity to speak on paper with thought and eloquence and care in a way that we rarely speak in life? I guess some of us have been scared away, although I'm a huge fan of teachers, and I say all the time that I would not be a writer had it not been for the teachers who gave me constant positive reinforcement. The flip side is that most of us growing up had at least one teacher who desperately wanted us to abandon our own writing voices, who wanted us to write stiff little set pieces with straight arrow sentences. My own kids had one teacher, I just loved her except for this. She had this set of rules. No connectives at the beginning of sentences, no sentences longer than two lines, no more than one be verb, is, was, are, in any paragraph. Just out of curiosity, one day I looked at the group of my New York Times columns that had been submitted to Columbia University. From that teacher, I would have gotten an F on each of those columns, and Columbia gave me a Pulitzer. I mean, talking about talking to students, let me be clear about one thing that I always say to them over and over again. I hate to write. I really hate to write. I hate looking at a blank screen and trying to figure out how to fill it again. I hate having a vision of a perfect paragraph or a perfect scene in my mind, and then when I finally sit down, having it come out less than perfect when it's written down. I hate having to do it over and over again. I mean, with a book like Every Last One, I finish a 350-page manuscript. I have my last conversation with the copy editor. I approve the jacket art. And then I think, oh, my God, it's all going to start again. New made-up people, new made-up places, new paragraphs that I know will sometimes be DOA on the page. So it's probably because of working at home and perhaps the fact that I'm female, but I always think of it as like housework. You know, you wash the dishes and you put them away so the next day you can take them down and eat on them and wash them and put them away again. I hate to write, but I love having written, and I can't have one without the other. And besides, I have to ask myself at the end, think of what you have. Right now, I have in my hands a novel that I think is the best work that I've ever done, that I feel I brought a level of purpose and control and ability to that I've never quite had in this form before. And then I think of what else we have because people write things down on paper. I mean, we have the Declaration of Independence. We have the Gettysburg Address. We have Bleak House. And sometimes all that you have, but it's so much, is yourself. I mean, I can go back and read what I wrote when I was 16 years old, mainly poetry. People in high school write poetry. They think they write poetry because they want to be poets, but they really write poetry because there's less of it. And they think that means it's going to be easier. Actually, it's much harder. Because if I have one ham-handed phrase in a chapter in a novel, it can have a pretty soft landing on top of all that other prose. But if you have one ham-handed phrase in a poem, you've written a bad poem. I mean, it's as simple as that. But when I was 16, I go back and look at that stuff, and I blush, and I roll my eyes, and I think, oh, my God. And you know what? I completely remember myself, too. I completely remember a person that almost scarcely seems to exist for me anymore. I can read the columns I wrote about my kids when they were small, and I can remember their babiness in a way that I find hard to remember now that they're tall and deep-voiced and adult. I remember when I was doing a collection of a column I wrote called Life in the 30s, a collection called Living Out Loud, which was basically columns about our two boys when they were young. Maria hadn't been born yet, and she has a constant grievance about the fact that she doesn't make an appearance in that book. And the boys were only 5 and 3 at the time. Quinn had just learned to read. Christopher hadn't yet. And I was really worried that when they grew up, they would look at these columns and think I had invaded their privacy. But my husband said, the greatest mystery for any kid is what their parents really think about things and who their parents really are. And our kids will know that. And that was such a gift from him, and he was absolutely right. So I think when we approach writing, we have to ask ourselves a simple question. Who are we? What do we really think about things? What is there about our profession or our life or our past that moves us? And what do we want to leave behind? I mean, there's only one sure way to make that last, and that's through the written word. I mean, you want to be immortal? Write somebody a letter. Tuck it in a drawer where they'll find it 30 years from now. That's what the written word is really for. And the payoff of all this writing and all this reading is so great. And we think of it as intellectual, but it's spiritual too. I have this paragraph from Alexander McCall Smith's book about the number one ladies' detective agency, when his heroine is considering the shortcomings of somebody she knows. And she says, "It occurred to Madame Romatzwe that such behavior was no more than ignorance, an inability to understand the hopes and aspirations of others. That understanding, thought Madame Romatzwe, was the beginning of all morality. If you knew how a person was feeling, if you could imagine yourself in her position, then surely it would be impossible to inflict further pain." In other words, what he's saying, what she's saying, is that empathy is the key to humanity. And reading and writing promote empathy. It's as simple as that. I mean, we read The Bluest Eye, and we understand what it is to be young, female, and black, even if we're older, male, and white. We read Sophie's Choice, and we're in the death camps. It's a miracle. And we understand ourselves, too. It seems to me that in a society like ours, in which isolation seems to be one of our greatest ills, reading connects us, and it makes you feel less alone. The stories of Hester Prynne, Little Dorrit, Jay Gatsby, Alexander Portnoy, they become our stories, illuminating our lives. Sometimes it's a puzzle to me how at a time when clarity and strength are so necessary and have so gone begging, we've moved so far from everyday prose. Lots of social critics trace that back to the demise of letter writing, the details of housekeeping and child rearing that people used to send from one end of the country to another 150 years ago. And then we had that period where almost all communication was done by telephone, which was the most evanescent period of communication, with everything gone into thin air, no matter how important or heartfelt. It was about 20 years when people stopped writing letters, but we didn't yet have email or Twitter, whatever that is. I'm sorry, I still don't really understand it. I mean, think of all of those people, and speaking of Twitter, think of all of those people inside the World Trade Center. I mean, if we did that now, we would have real-time dispatches from those people as that was happening, which is both a horrifying and almost a weirdly mesmerizing thought. But think of them all saying goodbye by phone, which is what they all did. I keep thinking that if only in the blizzard of paper that came down after the collapse of those buildings, if only there had been a letter falling from the sky for every family member and friend, something to hold on to, something to read and reread, something real. I mean, words on paper do confer a kind of immortality. Wouldn't all of us in this room love to have a journal, a memoir, a letter, preferably in their own handwriting, from those we have loved and lost? Doesn't it make sense for all of us to think about leaving that behind? I mean, there's no question in my mind that reading off paper, as I think of it, is going to increase in the years to come. My husband has a Kindle, which I gave him for Christmas. I apparently any moment will be receiving an iPad, which he gave me for our anniversary. Will it mean the end of books in our household? Just no way. But public librarians, like the ones in this building, who I think of as the nurse midwives of literacy, are already loaning out e-readers to people. A library that got 10 e-readers as a gift reported that within a half an hour of them arriving, they had all been checked out. And there's no question that, once again, we're going to have the lamentations that we always have from the Academy about how real literacy is a lost art. The difference this time is that we get lamentations from the high-minded, from both sides. So we're going to have literary purists who complain that you can't do real reading on screen. And then we're going to have tech aficionados who are completely disdainful of books. I noticed this when I was looking at the online reviews for the book Game Change, which if you haven't read it, you should. It's a fabulous reporting job on the 2008 presidential election. And I'm looking, and Game Change's stars on Amazon. It's like a star and a half. I'm thinking, this is insane. And I realized it was all from people who used Kindles, who couldn't get it because there was a lag between the release of the hardcover book and the release of the digital version. And somebody had written, "This book stinks. The thing reeks of paper and ink." Of course, I immediately called my publisher and said, "Okay, we're releasing the hardcover and the Kindle version at the same time, right?" I mean, those of us who only want to hunker down and be transported or educated will look past both sides to concern ourselves with what books do rather than how they do it. I keep being cheered by a poll that Gallup does every, I think it's 4 or 5 years now. It asks one question: do you happen to be reading any books or novels at present? Okay. The last time the survey was done, in 2005, there were all these doom and gloom headlines because only 47% of people said yes. And there were all these things about reading is down, the good old days, oh my God. In 1952, the year I was born, only 18% of people said yes. So the good old days weren't quite as good as we like to remember them. There's always, even then, been a snobbery about discussions about how reading is going to die. That's because those are really judgments on human nature. I mean, if you're wedded to the idea that America is a deeply anti-intellectual country, it must follow that we don't read. Or if we do read, we read the wrong things, or we read them in the wrong way. And now we have e-elitism, the notion that the book is a hopeless dinosaur. Both of those kinds of snobbery ignore the tremendous power, thank you, of book love. Kafka once said, "A book is the axe for the frozen sea within us." I love that quote, and it makes me realize what a great responsibility it is to try, as an individual, to wield that axe. Every writer should feel that responsibility keenly. I know I do. Part of my writing process is to read my work aloud. When I finish the first draft of a novel, like every last one, I read the entire thing out loud. It takes about a week because I hear the clunks in an injudicious phrase. I hear the sentence where I think it looks fine on paper, but by the end of reading it, I can't breathe, which is God's way of saying I need a semicolon someplace, or maybe even a period. I hear the dialogue that when you say it out into the open air suddenly reveals itself as words that no living human being ever said. But I do it, too, to try to understand whether I've brought emotional truth and resonance to the table for our readers. Robert Frost once said, "No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader." Particularly important for me with this new book. Bad things happen to really good people in this story. I'm not trying to be coy, but I think a book is a journey, and I don't want to be standing here saying to you, and around this corner, what you'll see is, twice I read the entire book aloud, once after the first draft, once after the last, and I finally gave up, exhausted from crying. I let my elder son, who has a really finely developed grammar gene, and he was not educated by nuns, do the final copy edit because I was sick of crying. I started reading from the book the other night in Atlanta, and I found a typo in the first line of what I was reading. Felt like my head was going to blow off. And as soon as I got in the car, called Quinn and said, "Quinn, there's a typo on page 54. And he said, "Let me call you back." I figured he was watching the Yankees or something. He calls me back. He goes, "Mom, I have my manuscript. That typo is a copy setting error. That typo is not in my manuscript." I said, "Thank you, son. God bless. Go to bed now." And yet, the tears that I was weeping told me something that I first learned as a reader. I mean, if you feel what the writer feels, the writer has done her job. She's lifted you outside of yourself and put you wholesale in a different world. As a writer, I live in that world during the course of writing a novel. When I'm writing a first-person story like this one, I even feel like I live within another person. Like every morning I climbed inside Mary Beth Latham and walked around being her in her life, and then at the end of the day I climbed out again. But at the end of the process, I not only have to live in it, I have to make certain that the writer will do, that the reader will do the same thing, that the reader will live in it too, because that's what's really magical about reading, that we can be Captain Ahab, that we can be Elizabeth Bennet, that we can be Anne Frank, and we can be Robert B. Parker Spencer, and we can be Alice McDermott's Charming Billy, and we can meet thousands of imaginary people that seem so real that you feel like you'd recognize them on the street. And because of that, we are bigger human beings than we might be otherwise. Reading isn't simply an intellectual pursuit. It's an emotional one. I really feel like it lights the candle in the hurricane lamp of self. That's why it survives, through movies and TV and audiobooks and Facebook, too. I keep hearing it. The book is going to die. I just don't believe it. I can't believe it. It's too primal. It's too important. And without bookshelves, how in the world would I decorate? Thank you very much. I think I can take questions for about 25 or 30 minutes. And if you have a question, raise your hand. I'll recognize you and then wait for the microphone. How about this gentleman right here?
Thank you for coming back to the Free Library. My question, and I agree with everything that you said in your excellent talk, what observations can you share with us about the practice of reading and the usage of books in the rest of the world? And I'd be particularly interested in a sort of a contrast between Western Europe, much more like us from an economic point of view, and the emerging third world of Brazil and China.
Well, I think one of the reasons that you see that 18% figure in the Gallup poll in 1952 is because countries slowly but surely become literate and reading countries. So that I think that almost all of the developed nations are reading countries, although some of them face an interesting challenge right now that I've only become aware of on this book. You know, most of my books have been translated into 8, 10, 12 languages, and it's kind of funny because I get them and I'm not sure which book it is. I mean, unless it's a really good cover, I only recognize one word on the two words on the cover, Anna Quinlan. And the rest of it, especially if it's in Cyrillic or Chinese, haven't a clue. More and more, because of the kind of one-world atmosphere which we have in the 21st century, people in Holland, for example, or Norway, or France, say, you know, I speak pretty good English. I'm not going to wait for the translation of every last one. I'll just order it in English from Amazon UK or Amazon in the United States. So foreign publishers are really struggling with the question of which books to do in translation and how many really literate readers they will reach in translation who don't already speak the English language, which I think is an interesting conundrum. But in the developing nations, for example, and even in nations like China and India, there's much less reading for pleasure of, for example, novels than we have here. And I think that that's something that every country slowly but surely grows into. And some of the European countries you mentioned are even more reader-friendly than we are. For example, it's not coincidental that there's this huge raft of the very best mystery novels now coming out of the Scandinavian countries. Karen Fossum, Henning Mankell, Joe Nesbo. Those are big reading nations, and they have, those novels have this wonderful shaker-like simplicity that I think perhaps grows out of living in a nation where it's nighttime 9 months of the year. The woman up here on the right on the aisle. And then I'll come to you.
Thank you for a great talk. I have a question. When you talk about climbing in and out of your characters at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, does your family resonate with that? Are they like, okay, here's Mary Beth again? Or, you know, later in the day, with each book, do you change, like, after hours, so to speak?
Yes. My family doesn't even know that the Latham family exists until the book is done. Writing fiction is a hard thing to talk about in social settings. My husband's a trial attorney, and he comes home and says, well, today we deposed so-and-so, and there was kind of a glitch because he said that this happened and so on and so forth. And I suppose I could say to him, well, Mary Beth and Ruby sat down at the kitchen table and had a really serious conversation about what's going to happen with Kiernan. But none of it means anything until it's part of a whole. I think I was really lucky in my work process, having had three kids in 5 years and having them around the house, because I developed kind of a routine in which when they got a little older, I would take everybody to school in the morning. I would run home as fast as I could. I would sit down. I would write as much as I could in 4 hours or so. And I would always leave an hour between the time that I finished and the time I was going to pick them up. And that was the hour that I thought of as a kind of a psychological palate cleanser, where I would go from being, you know, Anna Quinlan the writer to Anna Quinlan the mother. In the years since, it has developed, at least in the retelling, that apparently I was not always very good at this. There seems to be a sense that there were times when the look in my eyes suggested that I was paying more attention to welfare reform than I was to playing Clue or making dinner. But I did always have that, and I still work almost those same hours, even though those children are not children anymore, they're adults. And I do leave that hour at the end. And on a book like this one, which is a really high-octane emotional story, it was invaluable in terms of basically letting me leave, which was really necessary. There were weeks and times, depending on what was going on in the book, where I didn't leave so convincingly, and there would be a sense from my husband or my friends that I seemed a little abstracted. But in the wake of that, with everyone reading the novel now, some of my friends with whom I power walk or with whom we have dinner are astonished at how chipper I seemed during the 2 years that I was working on this book. This lady on the aisle, too.
Why, I enjoyed your talk today so much that I would also like to hear what you had to say to Marty Moscahane, and I wanted to know when that's going to be done.
Actually, I did it. We were live on the air.
Oh, you were live?
Yeah, we were live.
Oh, I thought it was taped.
It was great. She's just so good. And we basically talked about nothing but the novel. I was ready to tussle with the Arizona immigration bill, but we basically did nothing but the novel, but it was from 11 to 12. But thanks for asking. On this side, there's a gentleman in bow tie.
Welcome from St. Bernadette's Parish in Drexel Hill.
Thank you so much. My husband says that Philadelphia is the only place he's ever encountered where people identify not by neighborhood or street, but by parish, because he met someone who said that he knew me from grade school. And no, he didn't know me. He heard that I was from Philadelphia and said, ask her if she's St. Bernadette's or St. Andrew's.
Right. But the great divide that's in the country today, do you believe that part of the problem is the fact that people who seem to focus that on capitalism versus socialism, and neither seem appropriate today? When we have a difference of a CEO and the lowest paid worker now 500 to 700 times, you know, what it was years ago. But isn't it be more appropriate to use the terms greedalism and justiceism? Because that's what we're really looking at, justice, as opposed to socialism. And we no longer have traditional capitalism, we have greedalism. And so whatever you can do with your notoriety to promote those terms, we would appreciate.
Well, let me take a slightly contrary view, despite all the readers out there who seem to think I'm a communist, which is a term that now seems so antiquated that I actually find it a little endearing. I think that we have to go deeper and think about why there are the feelings that there are now about big business. And some of it is certainly that the leaders of production have become estranged from the means of production, i.e. the people doing line jobs. But part of it is because we're a country that stopped believing in upward mobility. I mean, when I was growing up, there was a sense that you could go ditch digger to cop to lawyer, to judge in four generations, that your kids would always better themselves. And so while you looked at the CEOs of big companies and thought, how the hell does he deserve that kind of money, there was always within you the sense that maybe your son or your daughter could be the person who someday could make that kind of money. And I think what's happened is that we don't believe that anymore. And we don't believe that because to some large extent it's not happening anymore. There seems to be a lid on our society in terms of people's expectations of where their kids will wind up. And I think that that's produced a kind of a national malaise. I'm sure the president will never say that, since Jimmy Carter has never lived it down. A kind of a national malaise, combined with the fact that I think educated Americans who have a keen sense of history have begun to suspect that we may be living in the end of the American century, that in the same way that the British Empire gave way to this rough and tumble big country across the pond, it may be that the internationalization of so much work and so much finance and the like may mean that the era when the United States was completely dominant in almost every arena may seem to our grandchildren to be a quaint historical artifact. Well, you know, I think that's going to be very tough for this country. This is a place that's very invested in being number one. I mean, it's not an accident that we have those big foam rubber hands with with the fingers, or that you all are so proud of the Phillies. But I do think that there's kind of a sea change in our national zeitgeist and character, and that we're not a country that's good at wrestling those kind of deep things to the ground. And so what we're dealing with, again, is a lot of what's happening in real time and not so much of what there will be to look back on. In the middle? I don't know how you get the mic to them. Just toss it to her. Okay, I'll go from her to you.
Okay, cool. Oh, it's wonderful to meet you. I have I'm an ex-English teacher, so I've been teaching your works for years, and I just wanted to thank you for the material you provided. First of all, I want to take back probably a few years to right after you wrote Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which I thought was such a spiritual book.
That's Annie Dillard.
Oh, my gosh, I can't believe I
said that.
It's okay. All right.
I'll take Annie Dillard. I'll take Alice McDermott. I'll take I'm willing to take anybody's. And by the way, Maureen Dowd always gets complimented for my column. So it all comes out okay in the end.
All right. Well, anyway, I do have other things to say. I do have other comments on your work. One of them is you were talking about the handwritten note, okay? And I do, I'm a big advocate of the handwritten note. And I have a couple children in college, and last Christmas I gave them books, The Art of the Handwritten Note, which I thought for sure, since I write them, have written them over the years a good bit, that I would all of a sudden be getting this deluge of letters back. And that, so after they went off back to college, there sit the two crisp books, The Art of the Handwritten Note. And so that did not go over so well because they are saying, Mom, just email me. Just, you know, email me. And I wanted to touch on that a little bit about the importance of this handwritten note, because I think those of us who have lost relatives young on, I know I lost my father when I was just a child, and I just lost a brother last Christmas Day, and those particular letters that were exchanged have become the treasures of my life. And I think, and in the same way you were saying about the journal writing, I've always written in journals. And so now that, you know, your children grow up, they want to read those about when they were little and what they did. Oh, okay. My question is, how can you be so rude? The next thing is, but my next question to you is, when I'm wondering about the journals and fiction and nonfiction, the books that you write that are fiction, how much of those, you say that you've always, you know, written in the journals, can you, how much of those are totally, are fiction, nonfiction? Do you believe that you can write something that is totally a fiction without bringing in some of the material from
I think
your
when
journals?
I think when you write fiction, you bring everything you are and everything you've done to the table. But I think a huge amount of it comes out of your imagination. It's like you took every life experience you've ever had and you put it in a kaleidoscope, and then you turn it. And turned one way, you get one kind of character, and turned another way, you get another kind of character. I think the astonishing thing for me, as someone who's written both nonfiction and fiction, who was a reporter for years, and listened to readers say over and over again, oh, they make up all that stuff in the papers. And then when I started writing fiction, people would say, oh, that novel about you and your mother. And I'd go, no. It's not about me and my mother. Those are invented characters. We don't believe in fiction, which I find both amazing and, in an odd kind of way, exciting. I'll give you one of my favorite stories about fiction writing is this. Dickens is my favorite writer, And he used to write his books, as everyone knows, in chunks, and they would go out into the world and be sold and read and so on and so forth. And only afterwards would they come out in book form. And there's this wonderful story about hundreds of people standing on the waterfront in New York while the ship was coming in that was carrying the last chunk of the old Curiosity Shop, yelling up at the sailors, "Is Little Nell dead? Is Little Nell dead?" Now, Little Nell was not a real person. Charles Dickens invented her, and yet she had become so important and so vivid to these hundreds of people and thousands of others throughout the world that they stood at the water waiting to know the answer to that question. So on the one hand, most of us who do what I do invent almost all of what's in our books, particularly when we've been writing novels for a while. On the other hand, if it feels so real to the reader that they assume that we must know someone this happened to or it must have happened to us, in a way, you can't argue with that. The lady next to her has a question, too.
Going back to the beginning, you are sitting in your club chair, strung over the edge, and you're not down at the creek where you should be. Tell me how you got the scabs on your knees.
You must be somebody's mother. You know, it's interesting because my most resonant memories of my childhood are of being a bookworm. And I think that's so interesting that that's what we call it. We do sort of make it seem like a little bit of a weird thing. And young people come up to me all the time and say, "Oh, Miss Quinlan, I'm a bookworm too." And so it's kind of a geek secret society. But I think I was always trying not to be that person, not to be too smart, not to be too something. And I always ricocheted between the two worlds. It was interesting because the very same qualities that used to get me into trouble all the time when I was a Catholic schoolgirl are the very same qualities that got me an opinion column at the New York Post, at the New York Times, that I was, you know, the being really outspoken, the never keeping your mouth shut, the wanting to know about everything. It all paid off in the end. And that's why sometimes people will say to me about their daughters, "Oh my God, she's such a piece of work. I don't know how we're going to keep her, you know, keep her in check." And I go, "Oh, do not keep her in check, because what passes for a good girl doesn't make a great woman." That lady right over there. No, right over there with the black suit on.
I came all the way from Atlantic City. We don't gamble, but we read. I just want to ask you two things. Every morning I get up, I read A Short Guide to a Happy Life.
Thank you.
Did that man, I love it, and I give it as a gift, but did that man really just look at the view, the homeless man that you wrote about?
Oh, yeah. I was actually doing a piece for the New York Times on the homeless, how the homeless got through the winter, and I met him, and I never forgot it as long as I live. I said, "Why don't you come into his shelter?" And he said, "Look at the view, young lady. Look at the view."
That's why I moved there. But I want to ask you one thing. I fool around. I'm old now and I write. But I want to know one thing. Do you know how to spell? Did you ever have trouble? Because I have a dictionary in one hand and I have, I don't even have spell check. I don't deal with that. But I just want to know, did you have trouble spelling or were you always a good speller?
I actually was always a really good speller. And I know how to diagram sentences really well too. Right here.
Thank you. I was at Barnard a few years before you were, and I've been back there off and on to reunions and things. In fact, you gave a wonderful talk at the big reunion last spring. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I know you've been back there in various formats of your existence and your persona. How big a difference have you found among the students, if you can compare, in their approach to reading, their approach to the use of English, their approach to even our life, as is affected by going to a place like Barnard?
That's a good question. We both went to Barnard College, the women's liberal arts college in New York City. And I, in fact, am chair of the Board of Trustees at least till July 1 and have been a trustee on and off for the last 25 years. It's sort of unfair to use our students as any kind of a marker, because the truth is that most of them are hyper literate. A lot of them have chosen Barnard because they've heard about all the famous writers who graduated from the college. Zsumpa Lahiri went there, Erica Jong, Zora Neale Hurston, Edwidge Danicott, Elizabeth Benedict. I mean, the list just goes, and that's not even touching the nonfiction people, of which there are just as many. So a lot of them go because of that. And also, the curriculum is so built around writing, even in the sciences, in terms of the writing of lab reports, the clear writing of goals in your experimentation and stuff like that. So they're a very, very literary bunch, and they read all the time, even today. And I mean, you know, they do all the obligatory stuff. They do all the Facebook stuff. They do all the, you know, the online stuff. But I still think it exists at a really, really high level. And among many of the younger people I know, I mean, I'm very happy about the fact, and it probably should not be terribly surprising, that I do have three inveterate readers, and actually two writers, and that they read at a really high level, but so do so many of their friends. So again, I'm not as pessimistic as lots of people are about younger readers and writers. One more, that lady there. Yeah, you have to wait for the mic.
Thank you for everything. I've been following your columns, particularly even more than your books over the years. I miss last word. I miss that.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're still contributing, though, obviously, to Newsweek.
I agreed with John Meacham, the executive editor of Newsweek, that I would do 4 or 5 pieces a year whenever there was a subject that he thought. So about 3 weeks ago, I did a piece about the future of books in the digital age, because they were going to do a cover on the iPad, and I've done 2 about the president since he took office, and I'll wait and see what he calls me on again.
Yeah, it was fabulous. Everything
Thanks.
You write is fabulous.
Thank you.
What else are you doing now? And if you will, comment on the Arizona immigration law.
The Arizona immigration law is un-American. You know, in all the movies I've ever seen, when the police stop you and ask for your identification papers, you're in a fascist country, not in a democracy. Do we have a really, really serious problem with people coming over the border into the lower states? Yes, we do. But why do we keep doing this thing where we take a complex, serious, difficult problem and come up with a simplistic, numbnuts answer? That's exactly what we've done with this Arizona thing. And what we've also done is put law enforcement personnel in an untenable position, because this legislation gives them almost no guidance in terms of how to proceed. So you're going to have the guys who are inclined to dislike Latinos who will harass people. You're going to have the guys who are not so inclined, but who say to themselves, oh, my God, I've got to enforce this law, because there's a provision that says you can be prosecuted if you don't enforce the law. So there's those guys, and there's going to be the guys who honor the law in the breach, which is a situation we have too often in America, in which we have laws that everybody knows are not going to be enforced. And a year from now, if this law is not stayed, which it may well be because of different kinds of legal challenges or because of legislative action at the federal or at the state level, a year from now, I can guarantee you that we will have people doing a how is it doing 1 year out, and it will have done absolutely nothing to help with the illegal immigration system. A problem in Arizona. What it will do is have created an entire new class of crime in the United States, which will be called living while brown. And in a state where most people are tan, that is fraught with peril. I mean, I just find this shocking because, you know, we have a long line of cases about reasonable search and seizure. And this law doesn't account for any of them. I'm going to recognize you because you obviously feel strongly about this.
I do. I feel strongly because our government is not doing anything. And we don't live in Arizona. And we don't know what they're really going through with the illegal immigrants. And the governor felt something had to be done. He said it was far out, but it had to be done. If our government would do something, then Arizona wouldn't do it.
Well, let me say two things about that. First of all, I don't believe she signed this law because she thought it was a good law that would help her state. I believe she signed this law because she was pandering to the voters who are going to decide whether to reelect her again. I don't think that if she were not up for reelection, she would have signed this law. And second of all, when we say that our government needs to do something, again, we're ignoring politics. I do not think that there would be much hesitation on the part of the Obama administration, which just walked into this buzzsaw because we had 8 years of the Bush administration doing nothing about it. I do not think there would be much hesitation about coming up with comprehensive immigration policy, and I can guarantee you every single Republican in Congress would block it because they have no policy anymore except whatever he wants, we don't. And that's why we're at this stalemate. My heart bleeds, and I wait for the elected official who has nothing in mind but the well-being of the American people. And sometimes I feel like I'll wait forever. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.